Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is noted international and economic historian Neil Ferguson. His books include Civilization, Colossus, The Ascent of Money, and the first volume of a biography of Henry Kissinger. He's also made a number of documentaries for BBC Television. He's currently the Milbank Family Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. In his latest book, written in the midst of the pandemic, views today's global disaster in historical context through the lens of disasters throughout history. The book, Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe, challenges the conventional wisdom that the ability or failure to deal with a disaster is solely a leadership problem. He writes the common feature of all disasters, whether man-made or natural in the making, is a combination of operational and managerial error. Through history, he looks at natural disasters, pandemics, and wars as events that can either make a society better or expose it as fragile or ill-equipped. He offers lessons to be learned from our current situation, which has been exposed by what he says is a digital social network that profits from the controversy of misinformation and disinformation it disseminates. He counsels for more resilience in our societies and political systems moving forward for the next disaster, which is unforeseen today. Neil Ferguson is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Neil Ferguson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Rich.
Obviously, the current pandemic was the starting point for doom, but the focus of the book on how political systems and societies have dealt with all kinds of catastrophe is interesting and learning about our response to COVID from our past responses. What can we learn?
Well, I think if one looks at the history of the United States, we've certainly dealt with worse disasters than this. The 1918-19 so-called Spanish influenza was a lot worse in terms of the share of the population that it killed, not only globally, but in the U.S. And in some ways, studying that disaster helps us put our own in perspective. Back in March of last year, a lot of people talked about COVID as if it was going to be that bad. And you'll remember that another Neil Ferguson, not me, but a guy who spells his name N-E-I-L Ferguson, at Imperial College London, said that if we didn't do drastic lockdowns, then 2.2 million Americans would die, which would have put it in the same ballpark in terms of the share of population as 1918-19. At the time, I suspected that that was a slight, maybe more than slight exaggeration about the risk, because it was already obvious then that, unlike in 1918-19, the new coronavirus disproportionately killed the elderly. What made 1918-19 horrendous was that young people died. Actually, they were more likely to be affected by the influenza. People in the prime of life were the ones who fell sick and died. So that felt at first like a poor comparison. Whereas I was struck by the similarities in terms of the public health threat with the 1957-58 so-called Asian flu. Now, the Asian flu killed roughly the same proportion of the world's population as COVID has so far, about 0.04%. The U.S. had a much better experience in 57-58 than it has had in the last year and a few months. And one of the questions I ask in the book is, well, why was that? Why did we seem to take that much more in our stride? And I think that's a really quite interesting question, because 1957-58 is kind of forgotten. Nobody really talks about it. And I found it fascinating to talk to people who were around then who kind of say, yeah, I remember that. In fact, one of my friends told me the other day, he said, I was as sick as I've ever been in my life then. I was 10 years old, and I really have never been more ill. But we've slightly written that disaster out of the history books. And I think we need to think a bit more about it, because it's quite illuminating to compare the two.
Explain what we did in 57 and 58, because as you do mention, the United States fared better than certainly certain parts of South America and other parts of the world during that pandemic.
And this is a really important point to make, that, Rich, each time a pandemic happens, you get these extraordinary variations in its severity. And the same was true in all the big pandemics in the past. So I think what's striking is what we didn't do. In 1957, we did not do lockdowns. We did not close schools. We did remarkably little beyond fast-tracking a vaccine. And the Eisenhower administration's view, and this was the advice they got from the public health officials, was we can't stop this spreading, so we just need to minimize the disruption. There are going to be people who will be sick and miss work or school, but that is just life. And they were extraordinarily successful at getting a vaccine in just a matter of months, thanks to the efforts of a remarkable man, Morris Hillman, a Montana native who was the kind of vaccine king at that time, invented an enormous number of vaccines. So when you look back on 57, 58, there's none of the economic disruption that we've experienced. That was partly because they couldn't do lockdowns. Remember, they did not have the option in 57 to work from home. I mean, most Americans could not possibly have done their jobs at home then. There was no internet. A lot of people had no phone lines still. So we have to remember we had an option that didn't exist in the past to do pretty drastic restrictions on economic and social life. So one observation that I've made in the book is that, you know, looking back, our response to this was suboptimal because in 2020, we kind of dithered around in January and February into March. And then once the virus had spread pretty much to every state, we switched from complacency to panic and we did the lockdowns, which ended up, I think, inflicting a lot of unintended costs on our society, which we'll be living with for some time to come, without necessarily optimally limiting the spread of the virus. So one argument that I advance in the book is not that we had some simple choice between lockdowns or letting the virus rip. I mean, that was not the choice. The choice was really between acting as quickly as they did in Taiwan and South Korea in ways that made lockdowns unnecessary and hanging on until by mid-March we didn't have much alternative but to use a very blunt instrument, namely lockdowns.
What about places like New York in the spring of 2020, or even, say, Los Angeles this past fall and this winter? It seems like lockdowns were the only thing that could slow down the spread at that particular point when it was surging through a population and threatening to overwhelm, you know, the health system.
Well, the New York case is fascinating because most of the first wave back in the spring of 2020 happened there, or close to New York, and the rest of the country was, in fact, largely unaffected. And I think that if one looks back at what happened, if there was anywhere that needed to take early detection, early action measures, it was New York, the most dense of all our cities in terms of population. And it was also a city, one of two, that had direct flights from Wuhan right up until around January 23rd, the other one being San Francisco. So you certainly could expect, and I did expect, that New York and the Californian cities would be the worst affected places. A huge mistake was made in New York that was made almost everywhere in the Western world. We didn't protect the elderly in elderly care homes, and those accounted for a really large proportion of the deaths in that first wave. And Governor Cuomo has been much criticized for this, but it must be said that he was far from alone in making this mistake. It was made in most European countries, too. Of course, once you had got to the point that the virus was spreading rapidly through the New York area, you needed to do something drastic. You certainly couldn't just have sat back and said, let it rip. Of course, people changed their behavior anyway. And I think one of the most interesting findings of last year was a paper by Austin Goolsbee, the economist who you may remember served in the Obama administration, who noted that much of the reduction in mobility that happened in the 2020 pandemic happened before shelter-in-place orders were issued. So I think part of what happened was that people changed their behavior before they were told to. But that was not sufficient to check the spread because we were really quite slow to understand a very crucial and distinctive feature of this particular disaster. It's spread by super spreaders. Like 20% of infected people do 80% of the infecting, which is not like influenza. It's a very distinctive feature of a coronavirus. It has a very low dispersion factor. And also, this thing disproportionately kills elderly people. So 80% of the deaths were 65 and older Americans. So the smart way of dealing with a problem like that is to try to identify the super spreaders and the super spreader events, and those were nearly all events that occurred indoors where lots of people were yelling or singing or something of that sort. So a targeted response would have been to use testing to identify the infected, and then to isolate them, and of course to protect the vulnerable, to make sure that the elderly were protected. We didn't do that because we couldn't do it. At that time, when New York was being hit hard, we had no testing capacity at all in the United States. We just didn't know who actually had the virus. And that's probably the single most important reason why the first phase of the pandemic was so badly handled here.
In fact, you write in your introduction that perhaps you were one of those super spreaders in January and February because you were traveling incessantly and moving around and you had a cough. You don't know whether that was COVID at the time. There was no testing. But perhaps you were one of those super spreaders we should have been curtailing early.
Right, absolutely. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to write the book the way I did was to make it clear that although disasters involve millions of people, they're also individual experiences. I mean, each one of us has had to counter this new threat in one way or another. And as we do that, particularly in the early stages of a disaster when we don't quite know what's happening, we struggle a bit. And I wanted to be honest about my own cognitive dissonance. I mean, I remember traveling around a lot in January and in February. And in January, I was fine. And then I gradually got sick in the course of February. And I remember coughing terribly. It was a very painful cough. And trying to find out if I had this new virus. I was kind of obsessed with it at that point. I'd been obsessed with it almost from the moment I heard about this strange new illness in Wuhan, China. But I couldn't find out if I had it. And I'll never know because testing capacity wasn't really ramped up until if I did have it, my antibody levels would have come back down. So I'll never know if I was a super spreader. I think I probably wasn't because nobody in my family got sick, or at least not very sick. And the symptoms were not the classic COVID symptoms of loss of taste and smell. But looking back on January, February, I definitely had a struggle to know how to behave because I understood this that there was this risk. And yet I was very reluctant to just isolate myself. And so I was a little bit irrational about it. I remember putting a mask on a plane back in February, and I was the only person doing it. And I remember feeling sort of self-conscious and, frankly, like a bit of an idiot. And I after a while, I took it off. And so that illustrates a point that even if you think you're smart and you think you're well-informed, getting it right, doing the rational thing, is not as easy as it might seem before the disaster strikes. In truth, when disaster strikes, we are above all confused. And I think one of the interesting features about disaster through history is that one encounters that state of mind, even in the ancient world. If you go all the way back to ancient Athens, when the first great recorded pandemic occurs, and Thucydides is writing about it, one of the things he identifies is not only that people are dying in large numbers, but also the kind of confusion that reigns. People are in a state of almost hysteria and at the same time fatalism about the situation that they're in. And one can read that today, thousands of years later, and think, yep, that sounds familiar.
Well, one of the questions you set out to answer is when a situation like this occurs, a pandemic, a catastrophe, a natural disaster, the tendency, just like in wars, is to blame the leaders. And in fact, you look at it as more of a systemic breakdown, a managerial breakdown really on a lot of different levels. Was that at play in this pandemic in your mind?
Yeah, this is an important theme of the book. It goes all the way back to Tolstoy and War and Peace, one of my favorite books. Tolstoy makes fun of Napoleon in War and Peace and makes fun of people who admire or hate Napoleon. And he says that Napoleon and everybody around him exaggerated his own importance because it wasn't really just because Napoleon ordered it that the huge upheaval of the French invasion of Russia happened. And I've always been fascinated by that insight that we tend to exaggerate the importance of leaders. That's not to say that they don't play any part. Of course they do. But in truth, when disaster struck in, let's say, in the 1980s, when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up, and that was one of the most famous disasters of the late 20th century in the United States, viewed by an enormous number of television viewers, the impulse in the media was to try to pin it on Reagan in some way. And the story, which initially was kind of running, was that Reagan had wanted to mention the shuttle launch in his speech, and so they'd accelerated the launch, and it had been done in a hurry, and that was why the disaster had happened. And this is all complete nonsense. There had never really been any pressure from the White House to expedite the launch. What happened, as the physicist Richard Feynman showed in a brilliant book, was that for years, NASA engineers had been saying there's a 1%, 1 in 100 chance that this thing blows up on launch because the fuel is leaking, particularly at low temperatures. But the bureaucrats at NASA did not like that risk, so they turned it into 1 in 100,000, so that when they were reporting to the people funding the space shuttle program, they could downplay the risk. And this point of failure in the bureaucracy is Feynman's great discovery. And I think it's quite a common feature of disasters. So when a disaster strikes, of course the buck stops at the top. It stops with the president. Ultimate responsibility is with whoever's in charge of the government. It's the same in the UK. The prime minister is ultimately responsible. But the idea that the prime minister is making all the decisions that matter in a crisis is illusory in practice. There are people whose job it is, like there's a deputy secretary for preparedness in the Department of Health and Human Services. That's his job. And in 2020, his name was Cadleck, Robert Cadleck. And ultimately, we need to recognize that it was not all about the decisions that President Trump took. He made so many mistakes, it's almost hard to catalog them all. But the idea that if somebody else had been president, we wouldn't have had 500,000 deaths, I think is just a little bit too reassuring, because ultimately, many of the things that went wrong can't be directly attributed to Trump, like the failure to ramp up testing, which was clearly a failure at the CDC bureaucracy. And I think that's one of the key ideas in the book. I want us not to come away from this disaster telling us the reassuring story that if only we'd had Joe Biden a year early, none of this would have happened. Because that's not plausible to me, even allowing for the fact that Trump made matters worse in a number of ways. I don't think a different president would have avoided many of the mistakes that were made, particularly in the early phase. And indeed, there were moments, brief moments, admittedly, when Trump's instincts were not bad. For example, it was Trump who argued with support from some of his advisors that we should restrict travel from China in January. That wasn't wrong. Actually, that would have been a smart move. It was just about 2 weeks too late. But he was roundly criticized when he made that recommendation and indeed instituted that restriction. And I can remember the heated editorials in the New York Times and elsewhere saying that this was kind of racism. Actually, it was perfectly sane policy to limit travel from China as soon as we heard about this new virus. We should have done it far earlier, and we should have made it far more comprehensive. So I think that illustrates that, and we've now forgotten this, that in the early phase of the pandemic, it wasn't just people on the right who were saying it's just the seasonal influenza or it's not as bad as that. There were plenty of people on the left making that quite stupid argument.
I want to ask, you talked a little bit about the CDC and the WHO. We have all these institutions which have served us seemingly well in past crisis situations. Do you think we relied too much on that track record with this new novel virus?
I think that's a great question. One of the reasons I wanted to write a history book that took us through a whole range of different disasters, going all the way back to the time of Thucydides, was to see if there's something that's deteriorated in the recent past. And a good example of this would be the World Health Organization, which clearly did very poorly in early 2020 because it was inclined to believe what the Chinese government was telling it. And that was a mistake. I think they'd got too close to Beijing. There was a really crazy moment when a WHO official essentially refused to acknowledge the existence of Taiwan, the country that was doing the best response of any country in the world. And it was like, no, Taiwan doesn't exist for us because we don't want to offend Xi Jinping. That was a real downfall. The WHO in previous pandemics had performed very well. And I kind of show how under different leadership, actually the WHO had played some pretty important roles in the past. It had a bit of a mixed experience with Ebola, but in some of the earlier pandemics that I write about, the WHO did its job. So I think we can certainly say that the WHO was not only too ready to listen to Beijing, it was also slow to recognize that there was a pandemic. I mean, it took ages to acknowledge something that seemed to me, as a historian, I'm not an epidemiologist, but it seemed obvious to me by middle of January that we were in for a global pandemic, and I couldn't understand what they were waiting for. So yeah, there's definitely a need for us to look back and conduct a proper inquiry into what went wrong. It can't be acceptable that we've had excess mortality approaching 600,000 in this country. That certainly it belies our belief back in 2019 that we had a good level of preparedness. And I think we need to learn the right lessons from this, because, of course, disasters will keep coming. We can't stop that. And they will come in many different forms. We know that climate change poses some serious risk of disaster, and we can't know exactly what those extreme weather events will look like and when they'll strike. But my worry is that we're probably not as prepared in reality as we are on paper for those disasters. And frankly, the way California handled wildfires last year, I think, illustrates the point quite well. All credit to the firefighters, but California's management of obviously very flammable forest areas looks like a shocking example of inadequate preparedness for a relatively predictable crisis.
Are we talking about just the ability for people to build in places that are very fire-prone, or just the management of the forests themselves?
I think it's clear that because of the way California's managed forests, and particularly because of the way environmental regulations have prevented controlled burning, a great vulnerability has built up over the last 20 years. And ultimately, we've reached the point that there really is no obvious solution, because there's so much very flammable material that it would take a massive effort to clear it, and the possibility of controlled burns would be almost impossible to realize, because they'd have to be on such a large scale. So I think California has mismanaged its way into a state of enormous vulnerability, and it would be a mistake to say it's all about climate change, because clearly the really large wildfires are probably more to do with poor management than they are to do with rising temperatures. So that's just one of many examples. What I'm struck by when I review the history of disasters is that they take so many different forms that you're almost never going to get the one that you're expecting. And one of the challenges we face is that we know that climate change poses a major problem. We know that rising temperatures are going to destabilize the Earth's climate systems. But if we think only about that problem, it's very possible that we'll be caught out by something quite different. And I felt very strongly when I was thinking initially about this in January of last year, that we were at the World Economic Forum at Davos in Switzerland, having a great many discussions about climate issues. The agenda was dominated by climate, and a pandemic had already begun. I was running around the conference hall looking for people to talk to about this, and getting some strange looks when I said, actually, we have a rather nearer term problem than climate change right now. There is a pandemic, and it may already be here, because there were actually three, I think, delegates from Wuhan on the list of delegates at that conference. For all we know, it was a super spreader event. So we've got to be careful about myopia. We are good at preparing for certain crises that take our fancy, and that, I think, is part of what's going on here. We're not so good at thinking of all the different scenarios that we may confront. And this recent attack on the infrastructure, the cyber attack on the pipeline, is a very good example of what I think we need to worry about more. We are tremendously vulnerable to cyber attack on critical infrastructure. And if a bunch of crooks in Eastern Europe, who probably have some relationship to the Russian government, we don't know, but if they can paralyze a major pipeline and cause gas shortages in parts of the country, that's just a trailer for a disaster that could happen much, much sooner than the sort of 50-year time horizon of most climate change projections. So to be clear, I think climate change is a major issue, and we definitely need to think hard about what its consequences are. But let's keep our minds open to the wide range of things that can conceivably go wrong, because we just can't know which disaster we're going to get next. But we can learn from history that probably won't be the one we expect.
Now, when this book was completed, it was back in August, and we still hadn't had this fall and winter surge. You know, certainly you're seeing huge surges in India and Brazil. I mean, we're averaging nearly as much worldwide cases today in the pandemic as we were in January. I mean, it's 800,000 cases a day. And even in the United States, it's 30,000 cases a day, which was about what it was in August. So it's no sure thing that we were going to have that fall surge, although public health experts were warning about it. And of course, that surge was worse than probably we thought in the summer. Has any of that changed your viewpoints about this book and the pandemic, given the fact that, you know, this last 6 months since this book was written, it's turned out to be a lot worse than it was in the first surge.
Well, when you're writing the history of something that isn't over, you can't write the concluding part. What you have to do is to offer some scenarios, which was what I was doing writing in August. I guess I kind of signed off on the galleys in October. And I would say that there were two scenarios, and they're in the book, one of which was a very benign one, in which we did not get a really large third wave, because we'd already had a second wave in many parts of the country in the summer, in the Sunbelt areas, and the thing would be kind of over by Christmas. And then there was a worse scenario in which there would be further waves. And in that worst case scenario, there would be no effective vaccines. We didn't know when I was writing the book the results of the phase three trials. We knew there were vaccines, we just didn't know how good they were. And so we ended up with a curiously kind of middle range outcome where the pandemic definitely wasn't done with us. The third wave was the worst wave in the United States. India was hit, Brazil was hit by new variants, which reinfected people who'd previously been infected. And that was something that I think surprised a great many experts. The virus turned out to mutate more than we thought. And that's an important point that that we couldn't really have certainty about last year. So the vaccine efficacy is the great and wonderful thing that happened since the book was finished. And I think that's the reason I'm not too doom and gloom about where we're going, because I think we do have the technology to contend with this virus, even if we haven't yet figured out how globally to deploy that vaccine technology. But in the end, if you're asking, why did you write a book before it was over? This is not a book about COVID. It's only really in the last three chapters that I turned my attention to 2020. This is a book about disasters and our curious relationship to them, our fascination with them, but also our strange inability to know how to cope with them well. And I think the reason I wanted to get the book done was that we need to learn these lessons now. I mean, we're not actually in the position to wait until it's all over and then learn the lessons. We need to learn now the extraordinary importance of getting vaccination on a global scale, that it's not enough if we just successfully vaccinate North America and Europe. If we don't vaccinate South Asia, if we don't vaccinate the Southern Hemisphere, then the virus is going to be able to mutate until it figures out a way to get around the vaccines. And even if that's only a temporary problem, and I think it would be, because I think the vaccines, particularly the mRNA vaccines, can be quite quickly tweaked to deal with new variants, this still would be a major setback. And I don't rule out, by the way, that we have a fourth wave ahead of us coming in the winter, especially if vaccine hesitancy continues. And it is a depressing reality that there's still a significant proportion of Americans who are resisting getting vaccinated. And it's often Americans who really need to. I mean, I'm amazed that vaccine hesitancy is so strong amongst older conservatives and African Americans. They are distinctly vulnerable to the virus SARS-CoV-2. And this, I think, brings us to a really important difference between our disaster and past disasters. And past disasters mostly did not have to contend with the internet and its capacity for spreading fake ideas and conspiracy theory ideas, disinformation and misinformation. We have two contagions to contend with, not only the virus, but this contagion of nutty ideas.
Neil Ferguson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
International and economic historian Neil Ferguson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the Milbank Family Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. His latest book is titled Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. It's published by Penguin Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.